The Bible does not tell us anything about Abraham's youth. We know only his father's name, Terach, and the city of his childhood, Ur of the Chaldees. Of Isaac, the biography of, as given to us in the Bible, begins, Eileh Toldot Yitzchak. This is the history of Isaac. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah. But of Jacob, the third of the patriarchs, the Bible provides us a rather complete itinerary of the journeys inside and outside of him during his childhood. We know a great deal about him as a boy, as a youth. We know that he was the youngest of twins. He seems to have been slight of build, sensitive, empathetic, that he was an enthusiast. He was a malleable youngster who could easily be manipulated by someone with a stronger will than his own. Jacob was the favorite son of his mother, and Rebekah was a determined and ambitious woman who was somehow put off by the physical size, the masculinity of the elder twin Esau, and who preferred the sweet, gentle youth. The youngster who somehow was always playing indoors, whose skin was soft, who could be picked up and fondled and cuddled, young Jacob. The children were born in Isaac's old age, and after their birth, he grew quickly much older, and his years drew near to death. His eyes grew dim, he could hardly see. The time has come when, as patriarch of the clan, he would have to make a decision. To which of his sons he would leave the responsibility for the clan, the title of patriarch. And at that time and in that place and among those West Semitic peoples, the investiture of a son with this right of office was done by a deathbed blessing, which once spoken was irrevocable, a blessing by which the father passed the mantle of authority onto his son, usually but not always to the elder son. Now, Isaac had determined to give this authority to Esau, to the elder boy. He was a man of the hunt. He knew how to defend himself. He would know how to protect the clan. But Rebekah feared that she would be managed by, subordinated by Esau. And she summoned Jacob to her, and she said, "Your father has determined to give the blessing to Esau. He has told Esau to go out into the field to kill him some deer, to prepare him venison. Once he is strengthened by the meat, he will pronounce the final blessing. I want you instead to take Esau's place. I have made for you a garment out of the skin of a kid. It is hairy. It will, when you put it on, your arms will feel like the arms of your hairy brother Esau. I have prepared some food for you to take in to your father, which will taste to him like the venison. And I want you to kneel and to receive from him the ritual blessing." And Jacob was delighted with the idea. He was a passionate lad. The sense of adventure appealed to him, an opportunity to put something over on authority. And he quickly agreed to the masquerade, impulsively, without any thought of the consequence. And he put on this costume, and he brought in the food, and he knelt down before his nearly blind father. And he received the blessing, a blessing which said, "Yavducha amim, nations will serve thee. V'yishtachavu lachal umim, and peoples will bow down to you. Gvir l'achicha, you will be the mighty, the controller of your brother. V'yishtachavu lacha kol amecha, and all other peoples will bow down themselves, humble themselves before you." Now the episode is hardly an enlightening or ennobling one. It's one of deceit. It's one of ambition. It deals with the manipulation of people and particularly with the deceiving of a man who had been the sustenance of all of these people for many, many years, of Isaac. And yet there is so much in this story which is typical of what we now call adolescence. There is in the first instance that terrible gap of misunderstanding between the young boy who is physically but strong, who's heavy muscled, who is engaged in manly things of the outdoor and the sports which pit physical strength against physical strength, and the child who is of slender build and more sensitive emotional makeup, who prefers to be with his mother in the tents, who is more empathetic with people, who deals more in relationships. And there is all of that flush of excitement, the love of adventure, the lack of any sense of the consequences of one acts, which is part of the quixotic, uncertain period, impulsive period, which is adolescence. Jacob was very much a recognizable adolescent youngster. I can imagine him with the long hair and the slow, laggardly step as he moves silently through the rooms, throwing himself down here and down there, lacking the energy to pick himself up and to get going, always having some reason to remain indoors. He will not have to meet the challenge of the rougher and more aggressive youngsters who are outside playing the rough and aggressive games. Now, adolescence is a relatively recent discovery. The word does not appear until the 17th century. It was not popularized until the 18th century, when in 1762, the French writer and philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau set down in novel form his ideal educational system in a novel which he called Émile. He tried to describe in Émile the various stages of childhood and to suggest the forms of education that was appropriate to each. And he tried to describe here, between the period of latency of childhood and the period of adulthood, a period which he called the period of emerging, when we don't know when we wake up in the morning what particular impulses, what particular passions, what particular appetites will be surging up inside ourselves. When suddenly the depths of the human being are opening up one by one, and when we are, in a sense, pushed here and pushed there, really without any conscious awareness of what it is that's moving us and why, we have not yet come to grips with our libidinous structure, with the depths within. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in this book, spoke of the fact that in his understanding, the child was not the man and the man was not the child. That somehow during this period called adolescence, we grow into something quite different than we were as children. Our emotional makeup changes. Childhood is simple, black and white, no grays. Adulthood is full of grays and gradations. In childhood, we are told what we should not do and the decisions are simple. In adulthood, we know the restrictions of our society, but we also know that there are passions and appetites eating within, pushing us that way, this way, and that, and we cannot always control them. And Rousseau spoke in Émile of the fact that in his understanding, man was really twice born. Once he is born into life and into existence, and then later, he is born into a human being, into a man. And I suspect there's a great deal of truth in this nature, this concept of being twice born. It's really been the concept that's been rediscovered in our generation by psychiatrists like Eric Erickson, who's spoken of what he calls an identity crisis, of a moment when all the convulsions, all the pressures which roil within the adolescent, suddenly, because of some experience, fall into shape. The youngsters have the expression, they put it all together. And suddenly, they know what has been unclear becomes clear. What has been muddy and murky suddenly takes shape. And they have a sense that they know who they are, and now they can channel their strengths, their energies seriously and with single-minded purpose. When heretofore they felt themselves moving in all directions, spinning their wheels, as they put it, without making progress towards some uncertain goal. The adult says, am I true to myself? The adolescent says, who am I? And I see this very clearly each year during our confirmation classes when we come to that inevitable discussion of names. Usually it comes up when I talk to the youngsters of the names which Jews have in the synagogue when they're called up to the Torah or for their marriage service or from some other purpose. How they have a biblical, a Hebrew name. And in a sense, this allows them to live as Jewish persons, holy as Jewish persons, when they are in this Jewish environment. And the question always comes up, well, Rabbi, what does my name mean? You know, Kelly, Linda, John. And sometimes I know what their names mean, and sometimes I have no idea why their parents named them as they did. But they're fascinated. And inevitably, one youngster says to me, how do I change my name? And I'll say, well, what do you want to change your name to? And he'll say, or she'll say, I don't know, but I know that I'd like to have the choice. I might not be, you know, a few years from now, what I am today. And interestingly, we have in the story of Jacob an almost precise, highly dramatic, highly symbolized description of an identity crisis. Years after this first unseemly form of juvenile delinquency, when the youngster has been manipulated by someone with a stronger will than his own, and because he does not have ego defenses, because his will is not yet fully formed, he gives in to his mother. Years later, after his emotions have had a chance to develop and he's been knocked about a bit by life, Jacob determines to come back to his ancestral home from his exile, from his place of flight. He has dropped out. Now he wants to come back into life. And he doesn't know whether he'll be accepted. Esau drove him away in righteous anger. He had every reason to want to take out after Jacob. And he sends to Esau a letter pleading for forgiveness. And Esau does not answer that letter. So he takes his courage in hand and he begins to travel back towards Judea, towards the ancestral home. And he divides all of his possessions in two and he sends half of it ahead to Esau with again another letter pleading for forgiveness. And again the response is only silence. And then he sends in his anguish and his uncertainty, another gift, another bribe to Esau with another letter of abject, craven begging for forgiveness. And again there is silence. And finally he's alone. He's at the ford of the river Yabok. If he crosses this ford, this river, he enters the territory where Esau is in control, he's exposed. And if Esau sets up to kill him in anger, he has no defense. Shall he cross? Shall he not cross? And the Bible tells us, and Jacob was alone, and there wrestled with him that night a man, and he wrestled with him unto the break of day, and he could not prevail. And the man touched Esau in the hollow of Jacob, in the hollow of his thigh, and Jacob was wounded. And this unknown assailant said to Jacob, let me go, for the day breaks. Jacob answers, I will not let you go till you have blessed me. What is your name? Jacob. Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but you shall be called Yisrael, Israel, he who has wrestled with God and who has not been overcome. In that wrestling, in that moment when he had to confront himself, his fears, his adolescence, his childhood, all of his desires to flee from the responsibilities of life, he became another human being. And appropriately, he receives another name. The man is not the child. When the butterfly has emerged from the cocoon, it's no longer in this form that it was before. And so it is that adolescence is this period of transformation between childhood and adulthood. And at the end, at some moment, hopefully, it doesn't happen to all, there are these moments when we face up to ourselves and finally gain control of the roiling emotions. And that's the moment in which we become an adult person. But why wasn't adolescence discovered until the 18th, 19th centuries? If man is always grown in essentially the same way, if the emotions have developed and opened up at essentially the same years after puberty, why is it not that men were able to define and describe adolescence until really our own age? And the answer is very simple. We've always defined adulthood in purely economic terms. When a man worked or went out to work, when he was apprenticed, when a woman was married, they were an adult. And in almost all previous societies, people went to work 12, 13. The girls were married at 12 and 13. And when a Jacob wrestled with the angel, when a Joan of Arc had her vision, when a group of young people, whom we would call adolescents, but who were really young adults to their age, followed a Pied Piper or went on a crusade or suddenly performed some kind of highly erratic act, they were judged not as youths, but as adults. And their acts were seen as forms of aberration or revelation, depending upon the judgment made on them. But they were not seen for what they were. Acts appropriate to a certain stage of development. Acts which spoke of a turmoil, a tumult within, which the not yet fully formed person was still unable to totally control. And it was only in our day, when we had child labor laws, when we had a new industrial productivity which demanded that we keep our young people out of work till they were well enough trained for the highly technical jobs which the society needed them for. It was only then, when they were in school, that we thought of them not yet as fully formed adults, and educators and scholars and sociologists and people of this kind began to define this period called adolescence. Interestingly, the first textbook on adolescence was not written till 1904 by a man named G. Stanley Hall. And then it was published appropriately in America, the first country to move towards massive public education, to insist that there was much beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic, which a youngster had to know. So there emerges this stage of adolescence. It is now no longer a stage in which the man or woman lives out this period of stress and strain as part of the workforce. Now they live it out as part of the schooling force, as aside from the labor market, aside from the heavy responsibilities of adulthood. This does not minimize the pain, the anguish, the uncertainty of adolescence. It is still the time of erratic behavior. It is still the time when your own insides are constantly surprising you. When you are emerging, uncertain from day to day, what you will feel in response to essentially similar stimuli. It's still the time of high delinquency. It's still the time of rebellion. It's still the time of withdrawal. It's still the time of passion. All kinds of conflicting actions and reactions as the not yet fully formed person struggles to come into his own or her own place. But of recently in America, the adolescence which most of us knew began to change. Now a new series of pressures imposed themselves upon this adolescent world. Until our generation, adolescence was looked upon in this century at least, as a time of passage. The child man, the child woman, was separated out from her or his degree of adult responsibility. It was no longer necessary for her. They need not have feared that if they committed some act which was antisocial, the whole weight of the law would come down upon them. They knew that they were, in a sense, protected by family, by society, by the courts, from the innate, inevitable, erratic quality of their actions. But in the last 10 or 15 years, adolescence has changed, or rather the envelope, the environment in which young people have worked out their adolescence experience has changed. In the first instance, it is no longer clear to the young person moving through adolescence that he is moving from something which is fixed and known, childhood, to something which is fixed and definable, describable, adultness. He does not have clear adult models. But more important than this, it is no longer clear to him that the society, when he has completed his education, completed his preparation, will welcome him into its own. He knows that he is not necessarily an integral part of the social workforce. Why? because his society is now a society of abundance, a society of leisure. The unions in the society are talking of 30 years of work, 4 days a week, and out. He knows that the vocational educational high schools are always training people for occupations which were fit and needed in the last generation but may not be needed in this. How many computer technicians were prepared in the last 15 years to feed in input into these electronic marvels, and how many are today out of work? Whenever the society says, "I need you," the young person responds, "I give you the Peace Corps, I give you VISTA. I give you all of the political turmoil of the young in the last 15 years," which in a sense, and very basically, is a statement, "You don't have a place for me, I will force myself upon you, I will force you to consider me and to give me place, to pay attention, to consider me to be significant." But most importantly, a generation or two ago, as the child prepared himself through this period, he knew that there was manhood or womanhood beyond it. There were clear models, roles that he would have to play, a uniform that he would have to wear, a certain respectability that he would have to come into, manage somehow. He knew exactly what was expected of him, and he knew that somehow he would get through this turbulence, and that more likely than not, he would be able to enter the adult world. Now, instead of the passageway leading somewhere, it appears to him to be a dead end. What's beyond it? The adults that he sees are not very happy with themselves as adults, nor very clear, most of them, as to what their adult roles really are. The values of the adult society are all shifting. He's no longer certain that that there are a set of values out there which he can finally mature into and accept. Perhaps the confusion of his adolescence is indeed the reality. Perhaps that's the only thing that he need concern himself with: experience, feeling, sensation. That there are no absolutes, no duties, no obligations, truly, when one looks at things. And beyond this, the youngster today is faced with what one psychologist called a sizzling society, a scorching environment. When we were adolescents, there were places we could go and we could hide. We could live many experiences out in fantasy. No one said, "Go and do." Everything said to us, "Don't." And so if we thought of getting drunk or doing something sexually that we perhaps should not have done, we lived it out in our fantasies. We experienced it in our imaginations, and very often it was no longer necessary for us to carry out this act in reality. We had a door we could close. We were not being bombarded every moment of the day with all kinds of hypercharged emotions with which we were not really ready to cope. Violence, sexuality, TV, radio, drugs, violence, delinquency, the problems of the day, war. We lived a quieter kind of life. We could throw ourselves into books and with our imagination live out the various ways in which adults live and could come to some judgment about them. We didn't have to, we experienced everything vicariously, not necessarily in actuality. But today's youngster is surrounded by people who say, "Do it, try it." And everything is laid bare for them. There is no place to hide. There are no shadows in which you can move furtively about, experiencing, wondering, not daring, and therefore not doing. Today, every pressure is to experience, to do, to throw oneself into. A man by the name of Thomas Cottle is an educational research director at MIT School of Education. And in a recent issue of Daedalus magazine, he tried to analyze the difference between the children he now interviews and the adolescents of his own generation. He's a man of about 34 or 35. And I'd like to read you several paragraphs of his conclusions. In all my recent interviews with adolescents of ages 12 to 16, really they are long discussions, or what the kids call rap sessions, the notion of connection or integrity returns again and again. How are these new young people connecting with themselves, and as metaphorically as it sounds, with their lives? Not exactly in response to my questions, they have invented phrases like getting it together and we couldn't connect. Connection is contact, is drugs, having a contact, making contact. Just recently, I listened as a 13-year-old from a wealthy family, a girl spoke of her life, and she did so brilliantly. And I heard again and again these themes of connection. People were not around with whom she might connect. Knowledge, the stuff of school, was not connecting with anything, and above all, the outside and the inside, if in fact they had ever been connected, were now brutally skewered. A major difference between our generations is that, if I can only verbalize it, that today's young bring a social, external reality inside of themselves, a reality that has become overly enriched and excessively stimulated by a sizzling society that cannot any longer keep itself from hiding anything. Nothing is kept out of consciousness. As a result, a person is practically deprived of knowing just what resources now inside himself is truly his own. The question of what has been created from scratch and what has been consumed is more difficult to determine than it has ever been. Psychology, religion, politics, the media, medicine, all are producing divulgence and revelations. One result of this constant stress on revelations, on connections, is a recognition by young people, however well codified it may be, that in fact nothing seems to make sense and nothing connects. What had before seemed linear, logical, rational, and importantly predictable or calculable, now seems irrational, absurd, nonsensical, and irreconcilable. The pieces of one's family, of one's school and country, emerge as bits of knowledge that cannot be gotten together. The illegal has become legal, the impossible possible, the incomprehensible easily comprehended, insanity acceptable and seemingly normative. As many have said, the drug-taking experience reaffirms a fundamental romanticism as the brain remains a reliable source of unbelievable, and even more significantly, unanalyzable data. Now, what he is saying, I believe, is this, that our young people live in a society surrounded by stimuli, unable to escape from these stimuli, stimuli which go to the very heart of their libidinous nature, which drive them to expose, long before any other generation had to, the depths of their being. Long before they are prepared to be in love, they must love. Long before they are prepared to be competitive or to make deep contact with another human being, they must compete or make deep contact. Long before they can really cope with violence, they are encouraged to be violent, or else are encouraged to deny all violence, to cut it out from within them. And their psyches are simply not developed enough to deal with this kind of supercharged stimulus, the environment in which they live. And so they feel not at all connected up. What was happening to us happens to them 10 and 20 times over. They are more confused, more pushed about, more manipulated, not necessarily by adults, but by the whole world which adults and the media have created. What they need is a little bit of slowing down. Not an encouragement to go out and dare anything. Not an encouragement to live all day with some kind of electronic noise bleating into their ears. Not the encouragement to see every R and X movie that comes along. Not the encouragement to go out and to try every experience because, quote, every experience is necessary. You have to live something in order to know what it's all about. Rather, they have to be encouraged to live quietly, to pull back, to find privacy, to find moments where they can try and make the connection, connect up with themselves, learn who they are, dream again, fantasize again, live in a world where one tries many things but in here, and not necessarily in the act itself. And interestingly, since I've been talking about Jacob most of the morning, this is precisely what happened in Jacob's life. After Jacob had taken the birthright which was not his and fled, that first day, troubled, filled with guilt, recognizing now, as adolescents do, the impulsiveness of his act, filled with contrition, he lay down on the hard ground. He pulled up a stone as his pillow. The adolescent has a terrible need to flagellate himself when he has done what is wrong. And in the quiet of a Judean night, he has a dream. And in that dream, as I read to you, he sees a ladder reaching from earth to heaven. And on that ladder, angels ascending and descending. That ladder is the connection between ourselves and our hopes, between the animal and the divine. And he hears a voice speaking to him in this dream. And the voice says, "Fear not, Jacob. I will be with you. I will guard you. Anochi imcha, I am with you. Veshmarticha b'chol asher telech. And I will guard you whithersoever thou goest." And Jacob, somehow in the quiet, in his privacy alone, finds the confidence. He knows at that very moment of leaving, but it'll take him 15 years of life to carry out. He must go and experience and live, and then he will return. For he turns to God and says, "If you give me enough bread to eat, clothes to wear, then I will come back to the land of my fathers. I will return to my home." Our adolescents, if we give them quiet and privacy, we can unplug them a little bit from this hyperactive, hyper-stimulated world of theirs. They can find the quiet. They'll hear the voices, their voices. They know within themselves what they want to achieve. They'll find the stability, the solid ground on which to stand. If you and I, as parents, if you and I, as society, will only stop encouraging them to live out our own fantasies. We'll stop telling them, "I didn't have this opportunity when I grew up. Enjoy. Life is short." If only you and I will stop saying to them, "It's a great, big, wonderful world out there. Take as much of it as you can." Too much food is a stomach ache. Too much experience is a breakdown. Amen.